Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Friday on Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, and I'm really happy to have in the studio with me today to visit with Josh Marquis, District Attorney here in Clatsop County. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for finally getting here, Jim.
Well, we don't need to get into that, but it's been a challenge to schedule Josh. He's, as he explained to me, he's at the mercy of the court, and was able to manipulate his schedule to be with us today, and appreciate it. Thank you.
It's good to be here.
I usually like to start out with a little bit of a biographical sketch. So tell us a little bit about yourself and where'd you grow up and all of that.
Well, I was born in Los Angeles, but my parents moved. My father was a professor at the University of Oregon, and we moved there when I was about two. So I spent most of my grade school years in Eugene, and then we moved overseas, and I spent a year going to English public school and another year going to Italian public school, which was a great way to learn Italian since nobody spoke English. We moved back to California, and although my father was a college professor and I couldn't get free tuition at the Claremont colleges where he taught, like most kids, I wanted to be at least 1,000 miles away from my parents. And so I came back and went to the University of Oregon, where it took me 7 years, just like John Belushi's character in Animal House, to get my bachelor's degree, and 3 years to get my law degree. I worked in the DA's office in Eugene for almost 11 years, everything from bottle washer to deputy DA. Then I went from there to to a newspaper job in Los Angeles for a couple of years, then missed Oregon terribly, came back, worked in Lincoln County for 4 years in the DA's office, went into private practice doing criminal defense work for a couple of years in Eugene. And then for 4 years before I came here to Astoria, I was the chief deputy DA in Bend. And then for those people with longer memories, they can remember in just a little over 20 years ago, the woman who had been elected district attorney was indicted, arrested, convicted, jailed, and disbarred.
That was
in that order.
Julie Lenhart.
It was. Yeah. And so it created a vacancy, which was filled by appointment by Governor Barbara Roberts. The joke I like to tell when I'm outside of Clatsop County in Oregon is people's expectations were low and it was easy for me to exceed them. I just ran for my sixth term a couple weeks ago.
And you had a really tough battle against Mickey Mouse, as I recall.
Well, you never, 450 people voted for somebody else, but out of 20,000 voters, I figure if I'm not making at least that many unhappy, I'm really not doing my job.
Well, you ran unopposed the last time, didn't you?
I've run unopposed five times. The first time I ran, in which I'd only lived in this community for less than 60 days, it was a highly contested election, and I was very nervous. But obviously,
who was your opponent then?
A guy named Paul Flannery, who was at the time a deputy district attorney in Clackamas County, and he presented himself as a Vietnam War vet and tried to make much of the fact, of which I was very proud of, the fact that I had opposed the Vietnam War, and it was an interesting and brief and intense campaign.
Now, when you were over, in fact, you're still involved, as I understand, with the case in Deschutes County that seems to be ongoing. Can you kind of tell us, walk us through that case?
Well, I hope that that case is over with. In June of 1987, a really nice couple named Rod and Lois Hauser, who lived in the beautiful high desert area of Terrebonne, north of Bend, were murdered at 3 in the morning in their home by an 18-year-old honor student named Randy Guzik, who was subsequently convicted of aggravated murder and sentenced to death by a deputy DA who's now my chief deputy DA. The case has been overturned three subsequent times. I tried the case in 1991 again achieving a death sentence. And then I came over here. The case has been overturned twice more. And because of a promise I made to the Hauser family that I would see this through, never thinking that it would take me 20 years, I went back in 1997, and then I went back again 4 years ago, every time the same verdict. It takes 5 to 10 years for a case like that to be reviewed by the appellate courts. So it'll probably be at least a couple more years if we know whether or not this last verdict takes, so to speak.
So it might actually have to go to trial again?
I sure hope not.
But it could.
It could, yeah. Yeah. Four times is actually the record for any case in Oregon history.
Well, that brings us to the issue of capital punishment. I know we spoke several years ago, and you were a pretty strong proponent of capital punishment. Does that remain the case today?
I wouldn't say I'm a strong proponent. I would say that I think it's a necessary tool in the arsenal of cases. And when I'm, for example, I'm pro-choice. I think a woman has a right to an abortion. I don't think that's an ideal method of birth control, and I'd rather have 15-year-old girls not getting pregnant or people, you know, who can't afford a child not being forced to have one. But I think it's available. I see capital punishment the same way. To give you an idea, in the 20 years I've been DA in this county, I have had the opportunity at least 5 or 6 times to ask for the death penalty. I've only asked for it once, and the jury said no. So the point is that I think the death penalty is something that should rarely be sought, rarely imposed, and is rarely deserved.
But, Josh, we're the only developed country that has the death penalty.
Well, I wouldn't, unless you consider Japan and India undeveloped countries, I wouldn't call it say that.
Well, in China.
Well, yeah, there are a whole host of countries that we probably would not like to associate ourselves with, like Saudi Arabia, Syria, countries like that that have it. But unless, I mean, two of the largest non-white democracies in the world, Japan and India, have and use the death penalty. The reality is that the Europeans have abolished the death penalty largely because it is literally a requirement to enter the European Union for economic reasons that you have to. Polls taken in Europe show routinely that if voters in those countries had a chance, as they do in the United States, that virtually every nation, with the exception of France, would choose to have it. In the United States, we let every state make that decision. There are currently 34 states, like Oregon, that have the death penalty, 16 that don't. There has not been a single state in 50 years since Oregon abolished it in 1964 where the voters have said no. And they've had the opportunity. As recently as 2 years ago in California, there was a very well-funded campaign to abolish the death penalty. California is a very progressive and democratic state, and voters said no.
And in Oregon now, we don't have the death penalty because Governor Kitzhaber has temporarily suspended it?
John Kitzhaber, the only two executions that have happened in 50 years happened during his first term. And John has never made a secret of the fact that he's personally against the death penalty. And that's not and I was very supportive of him his first two elections because I'm not a one-issue candidate. A lot of people I know disagree with me on that subject. And, I certainly don't define my career by that. But what Kitzhaber decided was relatively recently that he just wasn't going to allow it and granted what he called a reprieve over the objection of somebody who wanted to be executed. So essentially what the governor has said, although the trial court said he couldn't do it, the Supreme Court said he could, was he just said, not on my watch. The odds, Jim, of another person even being eligible for the death penalty, assuming that Kitzhaber is reelected, which is, I think, highly likely, are remote. Mr. Guzik, for example, who's been sentenced to death, who's been the person on death row longer than anybody in Oregon history, I believe will probably live longer on death row than I will on this earth.
Well, I could see then perhaps why he might want to be executed. Now, a month or so back, there was an attempted execution down in Oklahoma that went horribly awry. And it seems like those kind of things happen more often than we would like. And if there were no death penalty in place, that type of situation just would not occur. I mean, they couldn't find a vein in this poor guy, and they got the chemicals mixed up.
No, they did not get the chemicals. Let's be really clear on what happened in Oklahoma. What happened in Oklahoma was the guy had what's called a blown vein, which if you've ever given blood or haven't been like I have at the Red Cross, it will occasionally happen. It's where basically a vein collapses. It had nothing to do with the particular, what they like to call cocktail. And the cocktail, by the way, they were using were a combination of a drug called Versed and another drug called hydromorphone. If any of you are about you're my age and have undergone the unpleasant procedure of a colonoscopy, as have I more than once, we have had those exact same drugs administered to us. the usual, quote, concoction, the one that was used when Governor Kitzhaber, who is a medical doctor, was in charge of Oregon, is a drug called sodium pentobarbital. If you go to any of the vets here in Astoria and can get them to show you in their back room what they use to euthanize beloved pets, it is sodium pentobarbital. In other words, the drug we use to kill the worst among us is the same drug, A, that we use to put to sleep the pets we love. And more interestingly, in Oregon and Washington, which have Death with Dignity Acts, is the most common drug used by doctors who want to prescribe, who are willing to prescribe a end-of-life drug for those patients eligible and wanting to take it.
But now I understand that some of the companies that make these drugs are refusing to make them if they're to be used in capital punishment.
Pentobarbital is made by a company called Hospira, which is, like most big pharma, a huge conglomerate now owned by a European company. And yes, they've taken the position that they don't want the drug being used for that, so they will not make it available unless they can get an absolute guarantee. Well, if the drug went to Michigan, they wouldn't need to worry about it. Michigan doesn't have the death penalty. I guess I would just ask, what would the reaction be if we had a very right-wing state that didn't like abortion and that we needed a drug that helped ease a woman's pain during an abortion procedure, and that country said, well, we're not going to send you that drug because we don't approve of that. I think that's, yes, the answer is that, and that's why states are coming up with other kinds of ways of trying to make execution, which is really a little bizarre when you think about it, as absolutely painless as possible. Because what we never talk about are the deaths of the victims. For example, the guy in Oklahoma whose vein blew ended up dying of a heart attack about 20 minutes later. Well, no one ever discusses what he did to get there. He raped, abducted, and shotgunned a 17-year-old girl, then buried her alive, and then killed and shot her again. And, you know, I don't believe in revenge. I believe that there is a place for retribution. And because I don't want to spend the whole show talking about the death penalty, I think it's an interesting way of looking at what is the purpose of the criminal justice system. Is it to rehabilitate? That certainly has a place. Is it to punish? I think there is a role for that. And to differentiate between retribution and revenge. Revenge is a concept which is sort of like blood atonement, which has its bases both in Christian and Muslim religion. And that's the idea of, you hurt me, so I get to hurt you back. And that's not what our system does. We do not let victims, for example, stone people. We don't let the victims, you know, inflict pain on those who've inflicted pain on them. So, for example, in Oregon, for people convicted of felonies, 75% of felons never go to prison. They stay here in the community and they're treated here. Oregon has about the 32nd rate of incarceration out of 50 states. So most of what we do is working with people who do, in fact, remain in the community the entire time. And it's really an extremely small number of people who end up getting sent off to prison at all. And usually only because when the courts have just finally given up and just said, okay, you've had 11 chances at probation and, you know, you just can't keep clean. What we clearly need in our system is a lot more drug treatment, which we have very little of. We need a lot more mental health treatment. In Clatsop County, we have, despite the best efforts of people like Juanita Price from the NAMI group, we just don't have what we need.
Well, I've got one more death penalty thing to talk about. But before we do that, Josh, I need to remind our listeners that it's Coast Community Radio, and it's Friday here at Tillicum House. And I'm happy to be visiting with our local district attorney, Josh Markey. Josh, there was an article here in the New York Times three or four weeks ago that claimed that 4.1% of the people that, and I'll get to your quote, 4.1% of the people convicted of and sentenced to capital punishment have been convicted wrongly. And toward the end of the article, our district attorney was quoted in the New York Times saying something like, if that statistic is true, I'm going to quit my job and become a Buddhist monk.
That would be an accurate quote. This is an interesting discussion that goes on. For many years, the debate about the death penalty in America was a moral debate. The question is, really, did the state ever have a right to kill someone? And the opponents, who continue to be a very articulate, passionate group, and frankly tend to be well-educated, tend to be the elites of the educational, religious, and social institutions. People like my own parents, many people in my own family, believe strongly that it's wrong. But that argument just didn't fly with about 65% of the American people consistently. So in the mid-90s, they changed the argument. They said, okay, maybe there is a time when, but surely you don't want it to be A, racist, B, lousy lawyers, and most important, you don't want an innocent person to be executed. I mean, nobody can disagree with any of those. So they then started saying, well, look at this person who's been exonerated. So I've done intensive research. I've been extensively published on this. I've written articles for law reviews. I've spoken at universities all around the United States and even overseas. And the question, you know, in computer science, it's called garbage in, garbage out. That study that you cited said, okay, well, we've decided this group of people are exonerated. Well, what did that mean? Well, that meant they'd been found not guilty. Well, that meant O.J. Simpson was exonerated. Well, that's crazy. Our system is that if the state, if I, don't prove somebody's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, they walk. The benefit of the doubt goes to the defendant. Now, to say that everybody who's acquitted or not prosecuted is exonerated is insane. The number of people who've been, quote, exonerated off death row is about 25 out of about 8,000. And you could certainly say, well, that's 25 too many, none of whom, by the way, were executed, because we have this exact same system that you asked me about at the beginning, Jim, where this guy who I've prosecuted has been in appeals for 22 years. There's no question about his guilt. He's never claimed he didn't do it. Mm. He's never claimed that it wasn't a horrific murder. But he's entitled, and he's probably got 20 more years of appeals. And the reason for that is to make absolutely sure that we get it right. Now, do we? No. In no human endeavor. Frankly, you're more likely to be killed, with all due respect to the people who work in our medical community, in elective surgery or by your pharmacist making a mistake than you are to be wrongfully convicted.
You know, you kind of mentioned just briefly in passing the victims in these cases. Now, what kind of how do you approach the victims?
Well, that's very interesting, because when I started in my work, nobody really cared very much about what the victims thought.
Right.
And in fact, I think, in fairness, many prosecutors thought of them kind of as a nuisance. They were just, and that's changed radically. Starting in the mid-80s, there was a victims' rights movement. I was very active in it. And in 1999, victims' rights became part of the Oregon Constitution. So now one of the duties of my office is to go to the victims and say, well, what do you want? Now, it doesn't mean we always get them what they want, because going back to what I was talking about revenge and retribution, sometimes the victim says, well, I really want to see them do 10 years in prison. And I go, well, they're not going to do 10 years in prison. Or in a death penalty case, I've had victims, one of the conversations I always have in capital cases is sit down with the families and say, what do you want to see happen? And I have to say, I've been influenced by the fact there was a case here. Since it's a small community, I'd rather not mention the name, although people are going to probably know what I'm talking about, where one of the families was deeply opposed to the idea of their child's killer getting the death penalty, and the other family really wanted it. Now, I ended up offering him what we call true life plea, where he's in theory going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And I did that.
And
I
that's not always the case. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. In psychology, they say the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, and they're usually talking about people. I think you could apply that to institutions. If you went and looked at the Oregon prison system for the 30 years, 40 years in the past and said, okay, you said you were going to send this guy to prison for, say, 20 years for rape. What happened? Oh, they only spent 3 years in prison for rape? Well, until 1994, Jim, when someone was sentenced to life for murder, the average time they served was 8 years. Hmm. Life meant 8 years. 20 years usually meant about three, and 5 years usually meant about 3 months. Now, we've changed. We've gotten to a more truth in sentencing, finite system where, and it's, I think it's better for everybody, because if the victim knows what the sentence is, the defendant knows, the community knows, they believe it. And frankly, the sentences are shorter, but they're more real.
Right. I'm wondering, you know, it seems like nationwide the approach to drug awareness and prosecution of drug crimes has kind of changed. When I was a kid, marijuana, for example, was a serious scourge on the community, according to a lot of people. And that seems to have changed. And I'm wondering about, from your perspective, over the past 10 or 15 years, how's the prosecutor's approach to marijuana changed? And if possession of an ounce or less of marijuana is basically a misdemeanor, why is it 1 ounce? What is that?
Well, actually, you have to go back longer. I'm glad you asked that question. It's actually 41 years ago. In 1973, the guy I was working for in Eugene, the district attorney named Pat Horton, realized that in Eugene, we were convicting people who had literally one joint of pretty poor quality marijuana, about 2% THC. And they were getting convicted of felonies. Now, they weren't going to prison, but they were being labeled as a felon. It probably prevented them from being licensed and, you know, in the kind of job you had, the kind of job I had. And it was just wrong. And he said, look, you know, casual and incidental use of marijuana is not the same as, you know, quote, hard drugs, which was mostly heroin and methamphetamine back then. And unfortunately, again, is heroin and methamphetamine 40 years later. So we took what at that time seemed to be, you and I will remember it. I do this when I talk about marijuana. I ask people in an audience to say, how many people know what a lit is? And nobody under the age of 40 has any idea what I'm talking about. And almost everybody over 50 does. And for those of you out there who are younger, a lit was about an ounce, and it sold for, when I was in college, for about $10 to $15. And you could maybe make about 20 joints out of it if you were industrious. The idea was to take that was about a use amount. Now, the interesting part is that, of course, marijuana growing has become, you know, people become really good at it, and they've been breeding marijuana plants. So the THC content, which is tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient, has gone from 2% up to 25%. I mean, this is, as some people would say, some really awesome bud. So an ounce, as I understand it, there's now, I think, at least one licensed medical marijuana store in Astoria. I think there'll probably be four or five when all the licensing is done. And I'm planning on going and visiting there. I'm interested to see how they display their wares.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get in there, too. I haven't had a chance.
They're down next to Tokyo Teriyaki, apparently. Yeah. But my understanding is that a gram sells for anywhere between $10 and $25. So there's 28 grams in an ounce. That means an ounce. So to answer your question, it's not merely a misdemeanor. It's less than that. Possession of less than an ounce of marijuana in Oregon is an infraction. It's like a speeding ticket. You can't even be arrested. You can't go to jail. The maximum can happen to you is a fine. And to answer your question, over the last 20 years, the number of years I've been DA, I would say that the emphasis on marijuana has been really de-emphasized. We just don't see it unless it gets involved in commercial level activities or where people are selling it to kids. It's almost impossible to go to prison under Oregon sentencing guidelines, even for large quantities. What we're much more concerned about is a real plague of heroin and a continued plague of methamphetamine. It used to be homemade methamphetamine, and now it's methamphetamine coming up from Mexico.
Yeah, another thing that I'd like you to talk about a little bit, we've got 5 or 6 minutes left, is there's been this kind of kerfuffle involving municipal court and circuit court and the city of Astoria and Clatsop County, and maybe you can kind of walk us through
that. Well, you're probably being overly kind about that. It's a lawsuit I actually filed against the city. It has to do with whether or not DUIIs are being treated the same everywhere. There are three circuit courts, which are the courts of record. Those are the judges you voted for. People just reelected Judge Brownhill, for example. There are five cities in Clatsop County. All of them have municipal courts, and all except the city of Astoria send their drunk driving cases to circuit court. and to my office. And I need to make really clear, I don't get a dime out of this. It's not like I get, you know, a gold star for every DUI we prosecute. And so about 4 years ago, after case after case after case was brought to me both by Astoria officers, by the newspaper, by other people, I said, look, I'll take these off your hands, save you $80,000 a year. The reaction I got from the city council was nothing short of vituperative. It was, you know, oh, this is a vendetta, you're trying to get us. And I said, no, it's not. So first I went to the legislature and tried to get them to pass a law. The city council showed up there and basically said, you know, this is all a plot by Josh Marquis. The legislators voted 8-1 in favor of the bill. And then it got killed on the Senate side. So then I went to the attorney general's office and I said, what do we do? He said, file a lawsuit. So I did. And I won. And that has been appealed by the city, and it's up in front of the Court of Appeals. Ultimately, I suspect this is a decision that will ultimately be made not in courtrooms, but in the voting booth. In other words, the mayor and two of the council members are up for re-election this November, and I suspect that this will be an issue for some of the candidates. And for some people, they may say, hey, we want to maintain our municipal court. We think they're doing just great. And other people might say, well, the municipal court has a place, but not for try and drunk driving cases. My point is the drunk driver who is apprehended on the Megler, apprehended coming over Youngs Bay Bridge by the sheriff's office or Warrenton PD should get exactly the same treatment as the same driver who manages to make it over to the Astoria side. And that's not always the case. And that's in no way to denigrate the Astoria Police Department. I think they do a really good job. It's just that that's what me and my deputies are paid to do. We're professionals at it, as are the judges in the circuit court.
The whole thing seemed, from my perspective, to devolve into almost a turf battle rather than a legal battle, and almost a personality conflict. Did it look like that to you?
Well, there certainly seemed to be a lot of negative personality comments about me. I've tried not to make any about the members of the council. I don't know why many of them feel so strongly as they do. I had met with the mayor and the then city attorney and proposed it, and they seemed receptive to it. I've been approached, Jim, I would say hundreds of times in the last 3 years by citizens I don't know on the street. And almost every time it starts like this, somebody walks up to me and says, are you Josh Marquis? And I take a little bit of a breath and I say, yes, I am. How can I help you? And they say, are you the DA? I say, yes, I am. And they said, well, we just want you to know that don't give up on this DUII thing. We're with you. And that's great to hear. And I'd like to think that the 21 years I've been DA are partly that reason. It's just a question of being fair to people and holding people accountable.
Well, I understand. Thank you. We've just got a couple of minutes left, and I thought it'd be interesting if you could talk a little bit about your office and some of your staff and some of the people that you've got working with you.
Well, yeah, I am really blessed with an incredible staff. There are six deputy DAs that I would say do 95% of the courtroom work. Ron Brown, my chief deputy, is an incredible child abuse and sex crimes prosecutor. Don Buzzard also does a lot of those cases. I have two people in my victim assistance unit, Marilyn Riley and Ben Bradshaw, who are absolutely fantastic. My office manager, Lori Johnson. To give you an idea of how busy we are, each one of my deputies makes an average of 620 separate court appearances each a year. Now, not each one of them is a trial, but we have one of the lowest turnovers of any DA's office in the state of Oregon. Recently, the DA down in Lincoln County called me up and said, how do you do it? I mean, how do you keep these people? And the answer is, I got good people. I'm very lucky in that the county has given me the resources to run a good office. I've worked in other offices, and we're blessed in Clatsop County. We have the resources we need. We have what we do. And if it's done well, it's because I have good people.
Well, I see by the signal sent to me by our engineer that it's time to wrap this show up. We've been visiting with Josh Marquis, and I really appreciate talking with you. As always, Josh, you're an interesting interview, and you have some remarkable perspectives. Thanks for being here.
Well, maybe I'll come back in 3 years.
Yeah, and urge our listeners to stick around for Albert Smith's always wonderful Friday folk show. Albert has a wonderful taste in music, and it's always enjoyable. And so from Coast Community Radio, Jim Wilkins says goodbye.